So at the end of Kosamech Aleph, really at relatively did this relatively not Nageya, we'll finish off, and then I'd like to mention to you a number of issues. Mendy, if I could trouble you, I have a loose leaf on my desk in the study, on the table in the study. I had something I wanted to read there. And then I'd like to bring out some last issues that come up in Hilchos Ribbis. First, let's finish the Simin. We've learned till Sif Yud and Yud Aleph remain. Again, we're dealing with the main issue of this Simin, which was the issue of paying back Ribbis once it's been collected. Okay, I have to do it by memory. Repaying Ribbis once it's collected, and the fact that I think I remember where it is. If it could trouble you, on my shtenda upstairs is a Beis Lechem Yehuda. See if this put in. It's actually a photostat of an article. Okay, an English article. Okay. Again, the rules of paying back Ribbis. This is the last time you're going to hear it, at least in this format. The last time, we'll go through the rules. Ribbis Deiraisa, you have to pay back. It's Nitzva Bedin. Ribbis Drabanan, you have to pay back Lotzei Sidei Shemayim. It's not a Chiyuv Deiraisa, Ribbis Drabanan. And Ribbis Mukdemes and Ribbis Mulcheres there's no Chiyuv even Lotzei Sidei Shemayim to repay. That's the basic rule of thumb. Sifyud Yad Aleph, just some final aspects of the Simin. Sifyud, Imam Malve Sochar Mehaloiva Chayfetz, Ba'isei Dinishol Ribbis. The case is the following. The two Yidden agreed in a contract of Ribbis. He lent him $1,000, he's got to give him back $100 Ribbis. Later, when it came time to give the Ribbis, which was already set at $100, the person said, you know what, instead of paying me $100, you can, whatever it is, prepare my tax return, or you can mow my lawn, whatever it is, do work for me, and that work will be in place of the $100. However, really, the work is not worth the $100. It's a pretty common thing. It's not common that a person pays $100 for $50 worth of work. But when a person lends someone something and then he has to pay him interest, so it would be more common that he says, you know what, instead of doing that, work it off. And he gives him for a work of chatzi dinner, but the set ribbis was a full dinner. Maitzi and mimenu kol ha-dinner. The chiddush is that you might see the entire dinner since the ribbis was set as $100. The person was in dinei agreement, their agreement obligated to give him $100. He agreed to accept $50 worth of work for the $100, it's really the whole $100 that he's obligated to pay. On this sif, there is a machloikis, the sma, and the taz. It's in taz vav. What would be the din in a similar case where rather than work, the person gave him merchandise? Rather than giving him work, in other words, someone lent $1,000, you have to give me $100. Ribbis. Instead of giving him work of the $100, he gave him an object. He said, you know what, instead give me a pair of shoes or give me whatever it is that his line of work is. He said, give me merchandise and we'll count that instead of the interest. But that merchandise that has a market value of under $100 and he's taking it for the $100, well, pashtus, it should be the same since he's taking it for the $100, so therefore the it should be the same halacha that he has to give him back $100. However, the Tazia argues that it's actually here machlokes in the Taz whether when you give an object, it's enough to just return that object. In other words, when you give me $100 and when you owe me $100, instead of $100, I say, give me merchandise. The merchandise was $75, and that's ribbis. Do we say, well, I collected $100 I collected $100 chayv, and I used it to purchase this merchandise. So the merchandise is mine as a purchase, and the $100, which was never physically handed, but the obligation of the $100, that's the ribbis. And then you have to give the $100 back. Or should we say, no, the ribbis is the merchandise, he just returns the merchandise, that would be adequate. The Taz says, in the fifth line of the Taz, Taz Vav, Nira Pasha, tu adinim konami menu chayfet zekaka ba'is esach shalokach haribbis, loy dai laharza loy hamekach achshav. It's not enough to give back the mekach, the kibin shu sover v'kibbel hamekach, since he knew he was owed $100, and he thought about it, and he said, okay, I'll buy the mekach for the $100. Havalei ki'ilu nasan lai b'mizumin kol hadinor. In Yiddish, they call cash mezumin. Did you ever see it mentioned in Paiskim? The Taz says, ki'ilu nasan lai b'mizumin kol hadinor. As if he gave him cash, the full dinner. Ki'ilu lididei ha'yashavah lai dinor. V'ashav ein eyachol l'kaifai shi'yakach mimena ha'chefetz. He can't say, I'm going to give you back the chayfis. The kfar neschayim lay dinner ba'adai, v'ayin chafes likach ba'ayse chayfis. He did a good deal. He sold a $75 item for $100. He doesn't want it back. Zayin eshavim, achatzi dinner. V'hadin nakep v'gemar v'tur b'schiris v'lay memekach v'vusa kamash v'lan, etc. It's interesting the way that Taz looks at it as two deals. One deal that there's a ribbis deal for $100 worth of cash, and then there's a sale deal with $100 that you owe me. I took $75 worth of merchandise, and they're two separate deals. And this deal, the sale deal, is not chayzer; only the other deal is chayzer. That's the psak of the Taz.
If he wants,
no. Well, he can't give him back $75. He owes him $100. I understand. I think it's Dibur Bahaiva. No. He brings later to Sma argues in the in the second of the medium sized line. Kasafti Zait, Lafisha Biprisha, Prisha the Sma, Kosav, he says Fakarat. So this is the As you just say, whatever you work for me, I'll work for you. Well, Koita Smat certainly would not be good. The question is, Koita Prisha probably also wouldn't be good. Because when you give back the item itself, if you work for me and I work for you, it's two different works. It's not returning the thing that was taken.
According to the problem, why is the $500 returned? Why not the difference between the amount of work, the value of the accounting work, whatever work he did? That should be paid for.
No, it's not a knash.
If I'm doing $50 worth of accounting work,
right. Well, what I really have to do is pay you $50 for the accounting work, which was ribbis.
Right.
And now the question is, the other $50, did I ever receive that as ribbis? That's the issue.
Right?
So the Prisha looks at it, I never received it. I made an arrangement with you where I would get $100 worth of ribbis. And later I changed. I said, give me $50. So it became a $50 ribbis.
Right, so
So that's the way the Prisha looks at it. The Sma, though, looks at it as two separate deals. He says, if you think about it for a minute, the Taz looks at it as two separate deals. The Taz says, look, if there would be no ribbis prohibition, what would we say? I made a deal, you owe me $100. Then I used the $100 that I have in to purchase services. Now, I was a nice guy. I paid $200 for $50 worth of services, but I did it. Now, Hilchos Ribbis kicks in. The purchase does not go back, because what I do, I took $100 and I bought a $50 item from you, so you were very happy to sell me a $50 for $100, and that's done. That's not ribbis. The only thing that's ribbis is the original chayiv of $100. So that original chayiv goes back. That's hajra because of Hilchus Ribbis. But not the exchange for the $50.
So
right? It's two deals. According to Taz, you have to give him back the whole $100. Because the Ribbis application was $100. It's as if he gave him $100 cash, and then he in turn took $100 and bought $50 worth of services, or merchandise. So the $100 is what he received. So therefore, the whole $100 goes back.
He transferred the money from the person.
He never transferred it, but he created a chayiv. Remember, a chayiv is real. A person who owns debt, a chayiv is real. So he owns $100 worth of chayiv, and now in exchange for that, he purchased $50 worth of merchandise. It's two separate deals. It's a question of Aino. So the question of Aino would have to be dealt with in Achinami, if it was Aino, be Aino. If he, first, there's certain exceptions to Aino, and certainly if he told him that I'm doing it with the understanding it's Aino, and I'm Aino, that I don't mind. In Achinami, it would be Aino. That's true.
But when he did it, he phrased it.
If he would phrase it that way, he'd probably be right. In fact, when a person is owed $100 and he takes a $50 item, it's an incentive for the person to sell it to him. $50 to $100 is quite an exaggerated amount, but it's sort of part of the deal. It's a way to get the person to sell it more quickly or to do the services more quickly. If it was phrased as a mechila, I would think everyone would agree. You have to bear in mind that in the case of services, there's no machlaikis to preach in the taz, this man the taz. The machlaikis is only where it's merchandise. The merchandise is still be'en, so the preach also, if I give it back, I undo what was done. In the case of services, everyone agrees, might see a menu kaladina. Right, Sifyut Aleph comes up a bit more. Shtar sheyesh bei ribis, bei shel Torah, bei shel Devarim. When somebody drew up a contract, the contract is drawn, and the contract contains ribis clauses in it. Gaives hakeren levadai, ushiyad nikashu ribis. Obviously, you can only be gaive the keren. But even the fact that you could be gaive the keren is really a machlokes in the Gemara. There's a man d'amar in the Gemara, there's a Rameyer, I think, who holds that konsu atera atu isura. It's Rameyer. Rameyer holds that if somebody draws up a contract for ribis, then we kansa not the $100, let's say $1,000 loan, $100 ribis, it's drawn up in a contract. Now, there's no question that the loiva owes $1,000 to the malva, and that we don't kansa, we don't take away the $1,000 chayv. The issue is whether we take away the shtar from him. The shtar has ribis, Rameya holds, you have to destroy the shtar, and the knas is kansa atayra to isura. The shtar that he has to be able to collect $1,000 is not accepted in Bezdin because it contains a clause for ribis. We don't pass in that way. We pass like the chachamim. Halacha, what's the lashon? Halacha Rameya b'gzeiraisav aloy b'kansaisav. And the Rameya's knasais, Rameya was very tough, and he had a lot of knasas, and we don't pass in like Rameya b'knasaisav. And therefore, we pass in that the shtar could be used for Karen, provided shehu nikashu ribis. The shtar says, well, it's $100, but then there's a $1,000 loan, there's $100 ribis. Kugain shu meforish b'shtar ha-karen b'fnei atzmei, the Rama says. That means that in the shtar itself, it's clear that the Karen stands by itself. However, if in the shtar it disguises the ribis as Karen, then it doesn't work. We'll see why in a minute. Or if the shtar only contains the keren, the edim edim ala ribis. So there too, the shtar is good. If someone else gets a hold of a shtar that has ribis, then he should rip it up. Now, what's that going on? The shach holds. There's actually a machlokes rishayim in Masechtas above Mitzvah and Neshech. The Shach says, "It's Shach Yudches, a reishakai." Avok shaleinichtav b'shtar rak hakerem shitad loyikrenu. That's going on a shtar that that says that has the ribbis in it. If it only has keren, the ribbis is baal peh, so it's pshita. He says there's no reason to rip it up. Otherwise, chashina and sheyigva by haribis shakir tes. They say to Marcus, Marcus, I fill a mafurish by ribis deiraisa chashina lebez n'tayin. Even if it says beferish that there's ribis deiraisa, so what's the problem? He's going to go to a bezin to be teveya. They won't force him to pay the ribis. If al pikein, the shach says that like those rishonim that hold that you have to rip up the shtar, any shtar sheyesh by ribis. Avo, Shulchan Aruch finishes him. Ainim afurish ella shakayla karen imaribis ainim gaivabai afilu akaren. Then, if the shtar disguises the ribis as karen, then you can't use the shtar at all to be teveya. Again, shach chaf gazrina shema yigva haribis b'teres karen. We're afraid if you're going to manai with the shtar, you're going to manai the whole thing. Miu hecha daloiva maida yeshayim de gaiva. Some say you are gaiva if the life is made. Not clear why you need to be. Once the life is made, why you would need a shtar unless you're being teveya for mishubadim. Yeah. Anyway, this is the halacha of a shtar that is ribis. I don't think so.
No, there's one.
Yeah, it's actually a Gemara. The Gemara says that you have to tear up the shtar. Okay. What's unclear is the following. Tysus understands that the din of ripping up the shtar is not if it's in the hands of the malva. If it's in the hands of the malva, the malva is not mechuyev to rip up the shtar. He has it. He's being honest. So he could use the shtar to be tevera karen and not be tevera ribis. It's only kol misha baliyada yikarei hashtar. Only if a third person gets a hold of it, then there's a din of ripping up the shtar. That's Taisa's shita. However, the achrayim will bring this down. The Likud Svara, the Chochma Sadam, and the Shulchan Harav are saisim that a person should rip up any shtar sheish by ribis, which would seem to imply, not like Taisa's, like other Rishayim, that you rip it up no matter what. There's an interesting Taz Zayin who explains this. That if the Edim signed the Shtar Sheish by Ribis, this is going on. This is going, if it's Mefurish B'Shtar, Karen B'Fnei Atzmai, Dimlaikain, if the Ribis is disguised as Karen, then is that what he's saying? Then there are those who sign. Have signed the Isser. That's what the words he says. What? No, that he says in the next one that. Oh, I don't know the contents of the Shtar. Oh, you mean?
It's a complicated document. All they're doing is attesting to the veracity of the signatures. They're not attesting to the.
Typically, they would have to know, because typically, well. There's a rule, Kaisa Shtar Lalai Vafel Pishenam Alvi Imai. The rule is that you're allowed to sign a shtar. It's surprising a lot of people. You're allowed to sign a shtar that says you saw a loan, even though you didn't see the loan. It says you saw a sale, even though you didn't see the sale. Kaiser shtar l'loy v'afal pishen amal v'imay. Kaiser shtar l'maycher afal pishen v'imay. You're allowed to sign a shtar as long as the mischayiv, the one who stands to lose by the shtar, instructs you to sign it. Now, obviously, in such a circumstance, you would have to read it. Because for all you know, the shtar contains other facts that are to the that are detrimental to the malva. Truth is, even if two people tell you to sign a shtar, how do you know? Maybe it's mechayev a third party. Maybe the shtar says that a third party owes that money. It's really not practical.
I thought Adem would just have to attest to the veracity of the and the identity of the other signatories.
No, I don't think the malva.
They are the signatories.
No,
the if they're Ede Kiyum, if they're being Mekayim signatures, then you're right. That's not a typical shtar, they attest to what it says in the shtar. They witness the transaction.
Yes, but they're not witnessing the ribbons. They're not witnessing the contents of the Kiyum subsequent to the ribbons. In other words, through their memory.
No, Edem always have to know, generally, Edem always have to know what it says in the shtar. As a general rule. Now, what? Malva and Leiva did not sign shtaris. No. It's like a ksuba nowadays. The chassan doesn't sign, the Edom sign. Now, what you try to remember, I mentioned once that in Ksuba, the Ramah says not to instruct the Edim to read the Ksuba. I've been at weddings where Misadri Kedushin, you have told people, you're signing it, read it first. Why don't you read it first? What? He said to read it. Okay, I think there's a Ramon Eben Ezra in the first page of Hilchos Ksuba who says not to tell them Shaloi Laitzi Laz on previous Ksubis that are signed without the person reading it. The Edim could go and read it. But I think it's Ramah. The first page of Hilchos Ksuba, which is Simas Samach Vav, I think. So Ramah says not to instruct the Edim, even though it's right for Edim to sign. But Shaloi Laitzi Laz, so we... What? The language is standard, and usually I like to read it to see if you can catch some type of mistake in the... It's only standard in the last couple hundred years. Okay, the Ramah writes it, though. Ramah is 1550. And the Ramah still says it. The thing is, you know, you're hoping it's standard. I was at a wedding where the people signed it to Noam, they weighed them on the Tanoim, and they signed the Ksuba. They signed the wrong document. I mean, you know, they realized it, but, you know, it was a problem.
They wanted to do the people.
Try once at a wedding when they read the Tanoim to give him the Ksuba to read and see if anybody notices. Yeah. In other words, it says that I owe you $120, and really borrowed 120 as rivers. Right. It implies that that's the entire. Okay. The. How could Bez Din? They're not enforcing it, they're using it as a raya. They're enforcing the Etzem Chayv. The Shtar is only a raya. It is a raya. Okay. Kuf Samach and Kuf Samach, Kuf Nuntes, Kuf Samach, Kuf Samach Av, which we've learned, are basic rules of Ribbis. Obviously, they are more and complicated. Kuf Samach Beis is Saw Bissaw, which I did discuss with you. I'd like to discuss today another aspect, which Kusimikov Ayin, which we are not going to do inside, but there's a common application of a serious ribis issue in business partnerships. I was just involved in a sichsuch in business partners who were dissolving the partnership, and there were certain adjustments that had to be made, who owed who money. And they didn't even come to me, nothing to do with Hilchos Ribbis. And I saw that they're running their business for the last 12 years, being over in Hilchos Ribbis on a constant basis. And to adjust it now requires an accountant, I mean, to go through the very complicated issues. I'd like to discuss with you, first, the general rules of Hilchos Ariv, of being a guarantor, and then its application to business partnerships, and the not well-known issue when you have a business partnership of the partnership taking out loans, which the way loans are always bank will not give a loan to a partnership and say each partner is responsible for 50%, which would be the way we would want it. Each partner is liable for the entire loan, and that creates what? It happens the other way, it can, but generally it's not that way, and it's an issue. The issue which I had recently, when a partnership was dissolved, without getting into particulars, during the time that the business was suffering, they took loans to keep it going, and each of the partners separately took loans individually, and they were repaying it from the business, which is an issur ribis. If I'm a partner in a business and I go to my good friend or to my relative and I say, lend me $100,000 for the business and we'll pay you interest, so we'll pay you whatever, $1,000 a month for the $100,000. So what's that, 12%? Alright, $500 a month. So I'll pay $500 a month, and then a monthly they're writing out a $500 check from the from the business to the to the person. That's a ribbis. It's month after month. That's a ribbis problem. I borrowed money. Business didn't borrow money. I borrowed money. Now, it's my business. There's no problem. But if I borrow the money, I put it into the business, I'm lending money to the business. The business, I have a Jewish shutif. He can't pay interest for his part of the I'm lending him the money. I'm putting $100,000 in the business. Without a head to iske, he can't. Well, it could be from me, it could be from a guy. It's pretty much irrelevant. If one person alone... What? So if the business is a corporation, see, there's no personal liability. In this case, there's clearly personal liability because the business went under, and now they're sort of being today each other, whatever it was. There certainly was personal liability. So this is an issue. Now let me go through the rules. If I remember, it's a very interesting shaila. Each case has its own interesting twist, which makes things interesting. But what? A hetzer cannot be done retroactively. No, there are ways of adjusting the future to compensate, but first let's talk about being a guarantor. A simple case, someone is going for a loan, you want to be a guarantor, it's an interest loan. Now obviously, if a Jew is buying for a Jew beribis, you can't do anything. It's iser. If a guy is buying from a guy beribis, and they want you to be a guarantor, no problem. Guy to guy, no problem. The common case is where a Jew is borrowing from a guy, from a bank, let's say, and he asks his father, he asks somebody to guarantee the loan. Is that a ribbis issue or not? So, generally it is, but I have to tell you the background so that you know the halach. In Shas, there are three types of ariv. This is where it gets complicated. There are three types of ariv. There are three names for different levels of responsibility that the guarantor accepts upon himself. Ariv stam. What's an ariv stam? It just says ariv. A guarantor, in the halachic sense, has the following arrangement. There's a malva and a laiva. The malva must pursue the laiva in Bezdin or in court, whatever the case may be, and attempt to collect from the laiva. If he fails, he's unable to collect from the laiva, then the malva will have to pay. That's the arrangement. Then the arev will have to pay the malva. That's an arev stam. And the arev says, listen, you have to pursue him. If you're going to pursue him, then fine. If he can't pay, I'll pay. That's arev stam. I'm not aware today of this type of arev stam existing in the business world. In the business world, nobody wants a headache. Even you go to a gemach and you're a guarantor, they're going to send a letter to the laiva. If the laiva doesn't answer, maybe they'll send them two letters or three letters, but they're not going to spend money on a lawyer and go to court. They're going to immediately send a letter to the guarantor. I'll tell the guarantor, now you have to pay. That type of guarantor, from whom you can collect without pursuing the laiva, is called an arev kablan. Arev kablan means he's mekabel on himself as if he's the laiva. He really accepts the same responsibility as the laiva, and if he's approached, he has to pay. Now he can make a phone call to the laiva and say, listen, they're coming after me, you better pay. That's between him and the laiva. But as far as the malva is concerned, he's a kablan, he's equal. So going to him, and depending on his goodwill, is still an arev kablan. Now, if you're going to seize his bank account, you're right. But if the bank will not seize his bank account, if the bank will just, he doesn't answer, they send a letter to the guarantor, which in most loans, we'll talk about mortgage loans separately, most loans, that's the practice of banks, is that they, if the lender doesn't answer his letter, if he delayed, they give a certain amount of time. But if there's a certain amount of time and he doesn't, then they go to the ICU, you have an experience. We've had with the gemach very often, the shul gemach, you're a guarantor? Yeah, I'll be a guarantor. So you know a guarantor means you're going to have to pay. He says, really? He said, yes. As a matter of fact, sometimes we want post-data checks. I'm just willing to guarantee he's going to pay. I'm not willing to pay. You know, people don't think of a guarantor meaning that I'm going to have to pay. Like the whole complexion changes when you talk to them about paying.
Some orders.
You have to pursue him, either go to court or seize his bank account, seize his assets. What? Okay, we can argue about it. It has to be a serious pursuit in court. He has to seriously pursue him. Now, if everyone knows he doesn't have money, and it comes to it, does the light have to say, look, you're an Arav Kabbalah, so you're a Stav Aris, I have to pursue him, you know, why should I waste my time? I know he doesn't have. That could be different. But in the way things are generally structured today, now that's called an Arav Kabbalah. There is a third type of Arav, called an Arav Shleif Deitz. Arav Shleif Deitz is that the Arav is the first line of collection, and in effect, the Leiva is actually the guarantor. It's not common today. An Arav Shleif Deitz is a din of a leiva. If you guarantee an Arav Shleif Deitz, there's no question. So if a guy lends a yid money, and I'm an Arav Shleif Deitz, which means I'm the first line of collection, so in the eyes of halacha, I'm the borrower, and I'm in turn lending it to the yid, and that's certainly aser beribis, but that it's not a common Shleif Deitz. I took shot of Rashi. Shin lamid vav pei, dalit vav tzadik. Shleif Deitz. Wabshat is you take off his burden. Shleif, you remove, Deitz his burden. Actually, that's a second shot, remember. But the Shleif Deitz is not a common thing. What is common is an Arav Kabbalah. And the Arav Kabbalah issue is the following. To be an Arav Stam is mutter, there's no question. If a bank is lending someone money, and I'm going to be an Arav Stam, I'm allowed to be an Arav Stam. However, what happens is, he lends him the money in the year 2000, and for 2 years he's paying the loan, and then 2 years later he stops paying, the bank comes after me, I pay the bank, and now when I collect from the year, of course I can't collect interest from the year 2002 till the year 2020 when he pays me back, you know, for those 15 years or 20 years, I can't collect interest. At that point I become his malva. When I pay up his loan, paying his bill, I become his malva, and from then on I can't collect ribis, and that's a davar pashut. But that type of arav is mutter. The question is, what about an arav kablon? Am I permitted to be an arav kablon for a Jew, which is a typical case of a bank loan to a Jew? A typical loan today is an arav kablon. Simin kuf ayin. The Mechaber brings a Machlaikis Rashi in the Rajba. He brings that it's Asr, the Rajba Shita first. Then he says, V'yeshem Rishain, they Asr Ela Ela Ba'arav Shleif Deitz. And the Halacha, all Paiskim, Kemat all Paiskim, except for one Achrin, all Paiskim Paskin like Lechumra, like the Rajba, that an Arav Kablan is Asr. Now that means also means it's also to go into such an arrangement and to guarantee a loan for another person under such a circumstance, and that means that many or most guarantors to business loans are seriously problematic. And if it's already been done and the owner is never called on to pay, if somebody asks me, I already guaranteed the loan, what I do now, so just make sure that whoever's paying pays every month and that it never comes to it, but that you have to make payments.
When is the problem? Let's say Ruben lent money, I'm an artist.
The bank could go lend money to a year.
Yeah.
You mean you
lend a bar? I'm an artist. He didn't pay, so now I'm paying out whatever it is with the interest. So isn't it that I'm lending him that amount of money now?
Well, the question is, are you lending it now, or did you lend it 2 years ago when the loan was taken? That's the issue. When you're an Arav Kabbalah in the first place, are you a leiva? That's the issue.
And
that's the issue. Is it an aveira until he collects from Reuven? Once he collects from Reuven, there's no question.
If he only collects, he says, okay, too bad, I'm out.
Oh, he's willing to pay the interest himself? Yeah, of course. Yeah. He's willing to pay the interest himself.
Why is it a series of successive loans? And each time I'm paying the interest to the guy, it's another loan on behalf of the model.
That everyone would agree is true. Every time I pay, it's another loan. The question is only the original arrangement. with the original arrangement where I'm equally responsible. Remember, we always determine ownership by liability. And who is the owner, so to speak, of the loan? I don't mean the owner of the assets of the loan, but of the liability of the loan. They're both equal, the loiva and the guarantor. And therefore, in the view of the Rashba, the guarantor is really an equal borrower. And when the and he in turn is lending to the yid who's getting all of the money and using it, and his interest payments on behalf of the Arav Kablan are really payments to the Arav. He's paying the Arav Kablan's bill. So here it is, I'm an Arav Kablan, I guaranteed a $1,000 loan to him, and now he's paying back $1,200 or $1,300, and part of that is he's paying my responsibility.
Why is the loan viewed as a transaction that occurred at the time when the call was made to the Arav Kablan to pay
so
it?
The loan took place at the time the loan was extended. The payments took place later, but the loan itself, it took place at the time when the loan was made.
What do they look at it as saying? Is it the bank lent me the money and then I lent it to him?
Right.
But any of the payments he made directly to him?
Right, he paid your bill. It's the old question. Let's say I lent someone money. I say, listen, I can't take ribbis. Instead of taking ribbis, you just pay my gas bill every month. That's ribbis. So you pay my obligation. You're giving me money. So if the Arav Kablan is viewed as having an obligation to the bank, which is not totally in your not paying, but it's a real obligation, which is the way the Rashba looks at it, then you're paying my bill.
So then even if the bank even if you have a default, then I'm paying interest.
That's true, but I'm just saying once it's done already, at least do like Rashi, because Rashi would be made that if you're going to default, it's going to become a problem. If you default, I pay the interest and I get it back from you, that's going
to
be a problem. So. It's worse than a credit card because the credit card you're the loiva. There's no Rashi Shita to rely on. I've had people who told me in similar cases, I say this case, you know, Rashi Shita, so he said, okay, the Yom HaDin, I'll call Rashi in to help to be my defense lawyer. I'm not so worried. But, you know, if Halacha is not that way, it's not that way. Now I just want to get to two pratim. I'll take the questions. I just want to make sure I get to two pratim in this. Yes? Yes. Oh, you know what? I'd love you to be the Arav for someone. You're saying he's out of the picture. The Arav pays. And he doesn't collect from the loiva. He doesn't go back. He's not going to collect from the loiva. No, sure. Such an Arav is wonderful. If you know such an Arav, I have a lot of takers for such an Arav. A guarantor expects. I don't know if he expects, but he hopes to be repaid from the loiva. You know what? If there's no default, that's Machlokes Rashba and Rashi. Because he's seen as the borrower. The Arav Kablan, they're partners in the loan. Two partners are taking a loan, the Rashba holds. If me and you go to the bank and borrow $100,000 and we're equally liable, which is the way the Rashba looks at it, that means the bank is lending to two of us. So we each really borrowed half of the money.
And
you sure you saw the money? Your shliach picked it up for you. He picked it up. He was your business partner in the loan. I don't understand. You didn't give him a ton. You gave him a loan. If you want to give him a ton, there's zero issue. It's only if you give him a loan that it's an issue. You wanted to pay back your half. All right. This is really like two business partners, which is one of the issues I want to get to, who take a loan. Just give me a minute. I want to get to two business partners. It's very important to mention one possible exception to be chalukei deis among rabbanim today. But there may be a case in which you can guarantee a mortgage. Very often a son, a child, or a close relative takes a mortgage and a parent is willing to guarantee it. There is a situation where there are paiskim that are makel, contemporary paiskim that are makel. And that is, in the case of an Arav Kablan, where the bank will pursue the property first. In other words, there are certain banks that will typically, if there's a default on the mortgage, will foreclose. They'll send a foreclosure letter on the property before they pursue the guarantor. Now, it seems, and this I only know from secondhand information, that there are different banks that have different practices. Banks that are heavily into the mortgage business tend to foreclose. They have a staff that forecloses. I'm aware that Greenpoint Bank, generally, which is a big mortgage lender in Brooklyn, forecloses. They don't go after the guarantor. It's easier for them to just foreclose on the property and to take the property. It's easier than going after the lender and going after the guarantor, which always has complications. So the immigrant. Okay. So they go after the property. Now, I understand that Greenpoint is presently merging with another bank, so I don't know if it's going to stay the same or not stay the same. But in such a situation, the Apaiskim that say, there has to be called a Mashkin Toiv. Mashkin Toiv means it's got to be a good Mashkin. The property is usually a good Mashkin. The loan is for $100,000. The property is worth $300,000-$400,000. So that's a Mashkin Toiv. When there's a Mashkin Toiv, and it's either, certainly the best thing would be if it would be the obligation of the bank to go after the Mashkin first, then it wouldn't be a question. In that case, the Arev becomes an Arev Stam. Because really, he's not going to be pursued until they first pursue the Loiv in court. Because the Mashkin is owned by the Loiv, and therefore, that's a way out. Now, in the case of a mortgage, that's one way out. In the case of a loan, a person wants to make a major loan, and he wants a guarantor. The guarantor has rivers problems. If he'll post some type of a bond as a guarantee for the loan, and the bank will have to go after the bond first, then it'll be okay. Now, if it's a good bond, usually they won't even require a guarantor beyond the bond. But it's the loiver. Because we want to get the bank to pursue the loiver first to render the Arev into an Arev Stam. That's our goal. So if there's a Mashkin Toiv, and it's the normal behavior of the lender to go after the Mashkin, there are Mekilim, I believe the Bris Yehuda, which is pretty much somewhat of a Pesach Achron in Hilchas Ribis today, is Mekil, I believe, in this Inyan. And they are Mekilim. I tell people, if you're going into a Lechatchila, use a Het Iska. When you're talking about a property, a Het Iska is a Lechatchila, because property, in our times, properties go up all the time, and unless it's a high-risk property, but a typical mortgage today, I tell people, use a Het Iska, and then you avoid all the shilas. But strictly speaking, there are Mekilim, and there are Almi Lismach in such a situation. Now, to get to partnerships, yes.
Does it make a difference with the bank statement and the bank's practices what they do?
That's where they're medical. If it's the derech of the bank to pursue, that's adequate in the view of these paiskim. It's based on a chavis das, actually. It's not a new chiddush. There's a chavis das in Kofayin, I think Ches or something, where he has such a kula.
They're not obligated by law.
What?
They're obligated by their own past practices.
Yeah, that's a common practice. That's adequate. The origin of this heter is the Michas Yitzchak. The children of Michas Yitzchak. The origin is a Chavis Das, but in the contemporary terms, it's a Michas Yitzchak, which the Bris Yehuda brings seems to accept la halacha.
Why don't it sound different?
What?
Why don't it sound different? It's not enough.
We'll
come back to
the other. An Arev Stam, okay, the reason Arev Stam is mutter. If a guy lends a Yid money and I'm an Arev Stam, I'm not a partner to the loan. Right now, it's between the two of them. The day will come, and they're going to pursue me, and I'm going to pay them. At that moment, I will become a malva to the other yid, because at that moment, I'm paying his bill, and he has to pay me back. At that moment, but I'm not a partner in the loan. By an Arev Kablan, I'm an equal partner in the loan. It's like business partners who go and they take a loan, the partnership, a shutfis. And there, you have this issue. Now, talking about the partnerships. Obviously, if an Arev Kablan is like a partner, and therefore it's usher, if two people have a business and they take a loan for the business, which is typical practice, and the bank is not happy with the corporation guaranteeing the loan, they require the personal guarantee of one or both partners. The issue is a very serious issue, and it's very commonplace, and it's problematic. I recently had a case where, as I say, a business was 12 years old. It had a line of credit, which was guaranteed by one of the partners, not by the other. The bank accepted the partner who had better credit rating as the guarantor, and this has been going on for a very long time. The issue is... What do you mean?
No,
there is agreement between the two partners. No, the partners have a business together. The partners have an agreement. You take out a bank loan, and the business is going to pay the interest every month. They've been doing it for 12 years. I don't know that that matters. They're Lamaisa both agreeing to pay the loan. Well, what's happening here is one person borrowed money, and he lent it to the business. So he borrowed money at 12%. He lent it to the business. He can't charge the business. Now, the business could pay his half. Every dollar that comes out of business, 50 cents his, 50 cents the other guy. So the business could pay his half because he's paying it. But the other person is supposed to get 50 cents for every 50 cents he gets. The other person will get 50 cents. And that's not what they've been doing.
But
they've been paying with this.
Okay.
What?
They both guaranteed it.
Now, if they both guarantee, if each guarantees half of it, so if I did, it's okay. Because I took out, if I take $100,000 and you take $100,000, we give it in. Every dollar we take out is half mine, half yours. So I'm paying the dollar. It's like we have a business, and a business b'shutfis. And we have two credit cards, and every dollar I buy in gas, you buy a dollar in gas. So we use it to buy gas. So it's equal. There's no problem. We're just dividing profits. So we can pay bills. The issue is, in a situation such as this, where a person, one person guaranteed the loan, and he paid ribis from the company. This would appear to be ribis ketsutza, which is yaitzah b'dayanim. And the issue now becomes a very serious issue. There is a Taz, a famous heter of the Taz. The Taz itself is in Siman Kuf Ayin, I believe, Sivkat and Gimel, is interpreted by Achrayim in more contemporary terms to apply to us. Basically, the heter is as follows. And you know, Chazal say, "Ein shnei neviim misnabim b'singay nechad." Two neviim say exactly the same words. Follows. And you know, Chazal say, "Ein shnei neviim misnabim b'singay nechad." Two neviim say exactly the same words. Something suspicious. In the interpretation of the Taz, there are always loose ends, which different place can deal with differently. So you can start asking me questions about loose ends, but the basic idea of the Taz is very simple. The idea of the Taz is that if the person taking the loan, now he has to be an active partner, not a silent partner in the business. Why? We'll talk about it a different time. But assuming he doesn't have to be the only active partner, but he has to be an active partner in the business. He takes out the loan. The loan can be seen, according to the Taz, as a business expense. The business has expenses. The business runs. Obviously, you have two partners, and one of them for the business has to fly off to Chicago for a business deal, and the other partner stays here and minds the store. So the business pays for his flight. Why do you pay for his flight? He should get equal amount of money. The answer is it's a business expense. It's not a profit. It's a business expense. So Taz says that there's an argument can be made that this type of loan, it's really just a business expense. Now, what does it mean it's a business expense? The Taz says that as long as the business is turning a profit, the profits of the business are subject to the expenses of the business. And you and I are partners, and we have a grocery store. And at the end of the day, the cash register is full of cash. So I say, I'm taking half. You say, what are you taking half? I didn't pay my bills yet. I say, so what? Half is mine. So I can't say that. Obviously, all profits of the business are subject to payment for the bills of the business, the liability of the business. So Taz maintains that as long as the business is showing a profit, the profits of the business can be used to pay any business expense, and that this would be considered then a business expense, and it could be paid. The Taz's shita is that if the business is not profitable, that's the case that the Shulchan Aruch is talking about without problems. If the business shows no profit, in that month, the business expense heter doesn't apply, so the money's not coming out of profit. And then it becomes something which already the person who guaranteed the loan would have to pay the loan, and the business partner could not be asked to pay. Now, just to preempt some questions, if there's a carryover of profit from one month to the other, let's say in the jewelry line, October, November, December, people make money, hopefully. January, no one makes money in the jewelry line because I mean, if they're wholesalers, because generally the retailers are still stocked from the holiday season. I think in January on 47th Street they take vacation usually. It's you don't make much money. So I January didn't make money. All right, there's a carryover of profit from October, November, December, so that's okay. If the business reaches a point where there's no carryover of profits, but there is capital which is owned by the business, this is an issue which I can't tell you a psak. It's an open dispute as to what the tazah, how far the tazah's heter is meant to go. Is it meant to deal with capital of the business? If the capital is really just old profits that were turned into capital, that wouldn't be an issue. The capital is money that was originally put into the business by the partners. There it would be an issue. But as long as the business is profitable, there is no question. Even if it's not profitable this month, but it has a carryover of profit even from 10 years ago, there's no problem. When the business is not profitable, there the heter of the tazah doesn't apply, and there the issue is it becomes a serious issue. Yes?
If I lend a guy in a sense that I can borrow from a Jew with 5% and try that as an expense, or a Jew that's making money?
Come again. If you borrow...
My business lending guy in a 10%. I need capital. If I borrow from a Jew with 5%, I pay out of the profit to the guy who wants to pay me the 10%.
According to this, it would be mutter unless an exception applies that's not coming to my mind. That's the same thing.
For a general person, why can't you get a same
for a
it's my own business, not a partnership.
There's no issue in your own business. What's the issue?
I take a loan
Well, that's called an iska. Yeah, if you're paying it, if he agrees to be paid only from profits, that's called an iska. If there are no profits, you're not going to pay him.
Agree in the partnership.
What?
Did the bank agree to be paid only from the profits in the partnership?
Did the bank agree to be paid only from the profits? That's not a bank. The bank's agreement is not a promise. The bank is a guy. If the bank would be a yid, you'd be right. They would have to agree. The problem is the partner. The two yidden who are there, the problem is their relationship. So the taz's chiddush is that the taz looks at it that they're doing a business expense. If there'll be problems with the business, then the guy will pursue. Then only the person guaranteed the loan is entitled to do it, entitled to pay.
Yeah. Why is the taz's chiddush work mechanically? By classifying the business expense, at the end of the day, if you owe suppliers, both of the individuals owe half the bill to the supplier. We don't recognize the corporation in halakha. So the fact that I'm saying it's a corporate business expense doesn't mean anything in halakha.
If you follow your logic through, you'll see why it's a problem. You're right. So we follow it through. What you're saying is, let's say the business makes no profit. So now we have to pay for the raw material we took in. So we're both, each of us is going to have to pay him back, no question. So it comes the end of the month, there's no profit. So two partners sit down. They say, okay, we have a bill for raw materials. They say, okay, we'll each write out a check for 50%, we'll pay. They say, okay, now we have a bill, a bank bill, for interest. So one partner tells the other, that's not my bill. That's your bill. That's your bill. You guarantee the loan. The bank, the business has no assets. You guarantee that you have to pay. Am I guaranteeing your guaranteeship? I'm not guaranteeing your guaranteeship. I'm gonna in effect be an Erev Kablan to you. If you guarantee the loan for the business. The business has no profit. You have to pay. Now you want me to guarantee what you borrowed from the bank? I'm not allowed to guarantee what you borrowed from the bank. I'm an Erev Kablan, you buy for the bank, that's awesome.
And
it's half. The problem is half. The problem is not the whole.
The question is that when there is a profit, I'm doing the same thing and I'm an Erev Kablan. I'm reclassifying the business expense, doesn't change it because there's a profit. He has to pay the loan, and okay, now you're taking that on my share.
The task looks at it as an ISCA rather than a loan. The Taz looks at it as an iska, the money that was put into the business by the Taz really is creating it. What's happening now is the partner who took the loan is lending it to the business with the following rule. If there are profits, I get profits and we pay. If there are no profits, I take the loss. That's an iska. An iska is I'm liable equally and I'm profiting. So he's really turning it into
the next month we profit, we put it back into the loan.
If there's a, 1 month there's a loss. If there's a loss and they didn't pay.
They paid, it's finished. It's a long bad day.
It's an interesting question. Why would the Emmy have to ask if there's a loss 1 month and there's perhaps the other month? I'm not sure. I would imagine that you can't go back. Well, now there's an interesting twist to this in the case I recently had with these two people, and they were partners and they broke up, the business went under, and there were certain sesuchim of a pashut of a mamonis, which I sat down with them, we settled. Then I told them, you know, you have major ribbis issues, which could reach into tens of thousands, I don't think hundreds, but tens of thousands of dollars. There are ribbis issues on both sides. And the way I see it, to go back and get all of the ribbis payments, now each side took a loan. One side took a loan from the bank that went into the business, that's 12 years old. And the other side took a loan from relatives, which is 5-6 years old. And I told them we really have to calculate each month when there was profit, when there wasn't profit. It's very complicated. I suggested to them that it's up to them. If Alon wanted to be Tavei, he could. Hayois, it was already paid. Whatever was paid was paid. Mechila helps even Lechatchila. You're not obligated. If you pay someone with a Ketzutza, there's no mitzvah for you to go after him. I suggested that before they sit there and calculate, they just be Michael each other. I told them it's going to end up being a pshara anyway, because it's not possible to trace back each month whether you made profit that month, especially a Yiddish business where, you know, not everything is exactly on paper that can be traced. You know, you can figure it out. So I suggested, this is what I suggested. I sent the letter. I heard both sides, but I sent them a letter, and this was my suggestion. So I just suggested that since it's complex, that they do it. Gradually, as I was writing, I was thinking, you know, because I'll say somebody who's Isaac and Rubis, you know, the size of this Maitetin, you know, his business goes under. I was thinking, our business was running, but Rubis, it was really never a very successful business, and unfortunately, it was running for Rubis. Well, I didn't put that in. I didn't want to rub it in. But, so afterwards, which in principle they both agreed, one person came to me with a time. He said, as part of the adjustments that were being made to come to a final figure of who owes who, there was a figure of the person who borrowed money from the bank. They paid the bank every month from the business, and everything was fine. The person owed money to his relative. He owes his relative, so every month, you know, he gave him the, let's say, $500 a month, and every few months he would give the business an invoice and get it back. And that's the way it ran. At the time the business closed, it was 6 months worth of interest that was outstanding. He had paid his relative. So this person had an interesting taina. He said, I'm asking, should we both be Michael or with this that was paid? But 1 minute. Part of the calculations, he asked for an adjustment of $3,000 for 6 months worth of ribbis, actually $1,500 because it's his half. So he's asking for that adjustment. That adjustment is ribbis ktsutza lechatchila. I'm not allowed to pay it. You can't tell me to pay it. It's also for me to pay it. Because now I am paying ribbis ktsutza. So we'll be Michael everything else, but this money, he laid out the money, he paid his relatives, which is what he should do. He was the one who borrowed it. He's asking me now to pay him half the interest for that old loan. I can't pay interest for that loan. Now that's Ribbis Daraisa. Very interesting to me. What?
He's having
my
principal.
What?
He's having interest
in
his principal.
Oh, so that's the truth. The truth is, this was his tviya. So when he told the tviya over the phone, it sounded correct. However, Rav Moshe, as we once said, and this gets complicated, remember Rav Moshe says that all interest payments are calculated as principal payments, which means that it becomes very complicated. The outstanding balance included money that he paid. Look, the business folded. So he had guaranteed the bank loan, he paid whatever was left in the bank loan. He paid his relatives, whatever was included in his relatives' loan. Now they're making adjustments. The truth is that if you go through Vaishya's Cheshbon, everything that had been paid by one partner to the other partner, and he didn't pay the other partner, he paid his bill, Ramesha says you count it as principal rather than as interest. So that this opens up a tremendous can of worms for the person with the bank loan, because it's 12 years old. So let's just say, argument's sake, he borrowed $500,000 12 years ago. It was actually a line of credit, so it fluctuated, which makes it more complicated. But for simple calculation, let's say it was $500,000. And he was paying on $500,000, what is he paying a month? I'm not, let's say $2,500 a month, he was paying interest. Okay? So he's paying $2,500 a month. Every month for 12 years, he's paying $1,250 from the other person. But probably him, that should be deducted from principal, from the $500,000. Which means that actually, his timer should backfire in his face. Why? Because the other partner, if he wants, can say, look, you borrowed $500,000. I pay $1,250 a month of interest. Ramesha says that I'm entitled to deduct that from principal. $1,250 a month is let's say the loan was 10% a year. So over 10 years, I paid up the entire loan. My chalak of the principal is totally paid up. Now, the business folded, you paid $500,000. You're being tevel me $250 for my half of the principal. I paid the principal already. Because you borrowed money to the bank, you lent it to the business. Let's just talk simply. So every month when I paid, I'm really paying the principal that you lent. And now you're in big trouble. Because now I've been paying down the principal, I don't even know it. Except that in those months where there was profits, this argument wouldn't hold water. This only holds water in those months where there are no profits. So actually this argument, it sort of flies back in his face. And I don't know how it'll turn out, because the other loan was, 5-6 years ago. The first years they did make profit. So I don't know who would end up ahead and who would end up behind. But once you're going to start with this argument, it becomes very complicated. And Lamaisa, both sides are following my advice to just... 5-6 years ago, the first years they did make profit. So I don't know who would end up ahead and who would end up behind. But once you're going to start with this argument, it becomes very complicated. And Lamaisa, both sides are following my advice to just... this issue by having ISCA arrangements in the beginning of the partnership. You have a head ISCA clause which states that any loan made to it is done under the terms of that ISCA. The head ISCA has to be explained. If one's an active partner, one's a silent partner, it's easier. If they both know what's going on in the business, it's more complicated and it has to be done properly. Now, I bothered Mindy to go upstairs. Unrelated to partnership issue, which I don't know if this is new, your accountants will know. I was going to read to you part of it, but basically, there's a new chiddush that the IRS, I don't know if it's new to me, a chiddush that the IRS has. This is from a February 2005 accountant's journal. Loans that you make to your son. Your son's buying a house, you lend him $100,000. No interest, you're from the yid. Interfamily loans. Yeah, I'll have to read the whole thing to make it simple. Not the whole pages, but the beginning. Parents often make loans to their children or other family members so they can buy a bigger home, put a swimming pool in the backyard, or start a business. Because it's all in the family, these loans are often interest free and undocumented. However, family lenders should be aware of tax consequences of making intrafamily loans and should plan ahead to avoid unintended incomes. Intrafamily loans have both income tax and gift tax consequences if they're not structured properly. For example, a parent makes an undocumented loan to a child and does not charge interest. It's likely the loan will be deemed by the IRS as a gift to the child. The loan could unintentionally use up a portion of the parent's gift tax unified credit amount, which I'll explain. What it means is the following. The IRS says a loan is worth money. Every loan is worth a certain amount of interest. Now, they don't go with the bank interest. They have what they call the applicable federal rates, or the AFR rates, which means a normal loan is 3 or 4% these days. Which means if you lend your son $100,000 and you don't charge interest, they say, 1 minute, you're entitled to 3% to $3,000. Those $3,000 are actually a gift to the child. Because you're being Michael the interest, it's a gift to the child. Now, 1 second. I'm allowed to give $3,000 a gift to my child. I can give every year, what is it, $11,000 each parent can give a gift. There's no gift tax consequence. But it's more serious. The IRS says, no, you earn $3,000 interest and then gave it as a gift to the child. So they're going to tax you twice for giving this free loan. First of all, you have income tax because you made a loan. You took money out of your bank and you lent it to someone. Let's say you lent them $100,000. Let's say you lent them $200,000, $300,000. So you are getting 4%, which means $300,000, you're getting $12,000. That's income. It's true, you have Michaelis, you gave it to a child, but that's a gift. You can't give a gift unless you got something.
The IRS would be my brother, they
say you earned $12,000 interest, and then in turn you gave it as a gift to the child. Now, the one problem is you're going to have to pay income tax. And the second problem is that you are going to... The IRS problem is you're going to have to pay income tax. And the second problem is that they're going to look at it as a gift to the child. Now, each parent is entitled to give a child presently $11,000 a year to each child. The child's married to both, so two parents and two children give up to $44,000 a year in gifts. Now, when it comes to estate planning, it becomes a serious issue because parents, all parents should plan for estate because basically estate taxes, they still exist. If they'll be phased out, we don't know. But the way estate taxes work now is wealthy people pay zero in estate taxes. Poor people who have estates of less than $1.5 million pay zero. The first $1.5 million is excluded from estate taxes. The middle-income people who have $2-3 million, now you're going to say, I'm turning it around. You look at your house, you're right away, you're going to start pushing what you have. And it's a big problem. Many parents are reluctant to recognize that they have over $1 million. $1.5 million, I think. What?
Life insurance,
unless it's owned by the child, is counted as well. So if drugs is owned by the child, then it's not counted. But giving it to the child itself is a gift consequence. So the people who are really suffering by estate taxes, there was a well-known doctor, a very popular family doctor on 15th Avenue in Borough Park, who did not make estate planning. He was not a very rich man. He had a very successful business. When he died, his kids had to sell his house just to pay the IRS. The IRS looked at his business, which he was married to his kids, as having great value. It was a very successful business. They argued the business was tied to the person. He was dead. The kid wasn't a doctor. What's he going to do with the business? You know, the family business. And the IRS, the well-known NYSA, and all the tax accountants, the stakeholders, tell this NYSA to everybody because the kids suffered terribly. The parents put away money, and the IRS really hit them very, very hard. And there's a certain amount that you can do in planning. Now, if you gift your child money in a year in excess of the $11,000, the IRS counts that extra amount of the gift off your entitlement. You have a lifetime entitlement of now it's $1.5 million. It's going up, I think, every year incrementally to Orello, and the way it's structured, it goes back to when you're phased out, and then it goes back to the old, which means you have to be lucky to die in the right year, sort of. If you die too late, you're in trouble. It makes no sense. It was structured that way so they can decide later. The assumption is they can decide later. If they're phased out of state taxes, they'll not be again. There are ways of structuring things. Now, this particular issue has to be structured the right way. People are at a stage where children are buying homes and they want to help their child. It has to be structured in a proper way to avoid all of these consequences. Now, it's likely that if the consequences, the $3,000 or $8,000 or $12,000 we're talking about, that nobody, is that true? That nobody will wake up to it. But
It's something which, with the right amount of planning, could be avoided. If I was a lawyer, would argue that this basically requires for the written to charge witness. What the law is saying is that you can't get an interest free loan to your child. What? One point could argue that's a similar admission. I can't do. So it's a, it's something a person could argue. Of course, a way out is for the child to take, the IRS allows the free loan society to give free loans. I don't know why they allow that. I guess they're giving charity, any time you give out charity. There are a lot of free loan societies that give free loans. And, what? I don't know how the IRS would look at it, but if there was some understanding, maybe it would be different. And this is just an issue that I wanted to bring up to you. Well, we have one more issue, and that is where to go from here next week. As far as the remaining issues of the Srubas are not suitable for us to learn inside for various reasons. Some of them are complex, and some of them have a lot of non-Negeya type of issues. There's one siman which I couldn't, even if I wanted. There's one siman that has, is called siman kusamaches kusamaches. It's like if you had a trivia question on in halacha, which siman in Shulchan Aruch has two numbers, right? So the siman of kusim is called kusamaches kusamaches. There's no logical reason it should have two names. Apparently, it was a printer's error. When they originally set the siman in, I never heard of a good explanation of why it's called by two numbers. But it deserves to be followed. And, Chazal say, Ein shnei neviim b'snabim b'singai nechad. Two neviim say exactly the same words, something suspicious. In the interpretation of the Taz, there are always loose ends, which different places can deal with differently. So you can start asking me questions about loose ends, but the basic idea of the Taz is very simple. The idea of the Taz is that if the person taking the loan, now he has to be an active partner, not a silent partner in the business. Why? We'll talk about it a different time. But assuming he doesn't have to be the only active partner, but he has to be an active partner in the business. He takes out the loan. The loan can be seen, according to the Taz, as a business expense. The business has expenses. The business runs. Obviously, you have two partners, and one of them, for the business, has to fly off to Chicago for a business deal. And the other partner stays here and minds the store. So the business pays for his flight. Why do you pay for his flight? He should get equal amount of money. The answer is it's a business expense. It's not a profit. It's a business expense. So Taz says that there's an argument can be made that this type of loan, it's really just a business expense. Now, what does it mean it's a business expense? The Taz says that as long as the business is turning a profit, the profits of the business are subject to the expenses of the business. And you and I are partners, and we have a grocery store. And at the end of the day, the cash register is full of cash. So I say, I'm taking half. You say, what are you taking half? I didn't pay my bills yet. I say, so what? Half is mine. So I can't say that. Obviously, all profits of the business are subject to a payment for the bills of the business, the liability of the business. So Taz maintains that as long as the business is showing a profit, the profits of the business can be used to pay any business expense, and that this would be considered then a business expense, and it could be paid. The Taz's shita is that if the business is not profitable, that's the case that the Shulchan Aruch is talking about without problems. If the business shows no profit, in that month, the business expense heter doesn't apply, so the money's not coming out of profit. And then it becomes something which already the person who guaranteed the loan would have to pay the loan, and the business partner could not be asked to pay. Now, just to preempt some questions, if there's a carryover of profit from one month to the other, let's say the jewelry line, October, November, December, people make money, hopefully. January, no one makes money in the jewelry line if they're wholesalers, because generally the retailers are still stocked from the holiday season. I think in January on 47th Street they take vacation usually. You don't make much money. So January didn't make money. All right, there's a carryover of profit from October, November, December, so that's okay. if the business reaches a point where there's no carryover of profits, but there is capital which is owned by the business, this is an issue which I can't tell you a psak. It's an open dispute as to what the taz, how far the tazis heter is meant to go. Is it meant to deal with capital of the business? If the capital is really just old profits that were turned into capital, that wouldn't be an issue. The capital is money that was originally put into the business by the partners. There it would be an issue. But as long as the business is profitable, there is no question. Even if it's not profitable this month, but it has a carryover of profit even from 10 years ago, there's no problem. When the business is not profitable, there the heter of the taz doesn't apply, and there the issue is it becomes a serious issue. Yes.
If I lend a guy that has to step back and borrow from you at 5% and charge that as expense or interest to make the money?
Come again. If you borrow...
My business lending guy has 10%. I need capital. If I borrow from you at 5%, I pay out of the profit to the guy who wants to take the expense.
According to this, it would be mutter unless an exception applies. That's not coming to my mind. But it's the same thing, obviously.
For a general person, why can't you get the same borrower
for a
partner? It's my own business, not a partner.
There's no issue in your own business. What's the issue?
I take a loan from you.
Well, that's called an iska. Yeah, if you're paying it, if he agrees to be paid only from profits, that's called an iska. If there are no profits, you're not going to pay him.
You agree in the partnership.
What?
Did the bank agree to be paid only from the profits?
Did the bank agree to be paid only from the profits? That's not a... The bank's agreement is not a promise. The bank is a guy. If the bank would be a yid, you'd be right. They would have to agree. The problem is the partner. The two yidden who are there, the problem is their relationship. So the taz's chiddush is that the taz looks at it, that they're doing the business expense. If there'll be problems with the business, then the guy will pursue. Then only the person guaranteed the loan is entitled to do it, entitled to pay. Yeah.
Why is the time you have to work mechanically? By classifying the business expense, at the end of the day, if you owe suppliers, both of the individuals owe half the bill to the supplier. We don't recognize the corporation in halacha. So the fact that I'm saying it's a corporate business expense doesn't mean anything in halacha.
If you follow your logic through, you'll see why it's a problem. You're right. So we follow it through. What you're saying is, let's say the business makes no profit. So now we have to pay for the raw material we took in. So we're both, each of us is going to have to pay him back, no question. So it comes the end of the month, there's no profit. So two partners sit down. They say, okay, we have a bill for raw materials. They say, okay, we'll each write out a check for 50%, we'll pay. They say, okay, now we have a bill, a bank bill, for interest. So one partner tells the other, that's not my bill. That's your bill. That's your bill. You guarantee the loan. The bank, the business has no assets. You guarantee that you have to pay. Am I guaranteeing your guaranteeship? I'm not guaranteeing your guaranteeship. I'm gonna be an Erev Kablan to you. If you guarantee the loan for the business. The business has no profit. You have to pay. And you want me to guarantee what you borrowed from the bank? I'm not allowed to guarantee what you borrowed from the bank. I'm not comment on you buy for the bank, that's awesome.
And
it's half. The problem is half. The problem is not the whole.
That only answers the question, but then when there is a profit, I'm doing the same thing and I'm not a problem. I'm reclassifying the business expense, doesn't change it because there's a profit. He has to pay the loan, and okay, now you're taking that on my share.
The task looks at it as an ISCA rather than a loan. The Taz looks at it as an iska, the money that was put into the business by the Taz really is creating it. What's happening now is the partner who took the loan is lending it to the business with the following rule. If there are profits, I get profits and we pay. If there are no profits, I take the loss. That's an iska. An iska is I'm liable equally and I'm profiting. So he's really turning it into
an iska.
If there's one month there's a loss, if there's a loss and they didn't pay...
They pay, it's finished, it's a long bad day. Second, 2 months down, you make big money.
It's an interesting question. Why would be every head to ask? There's a law for Amant and there's perhaps the other, but I'm not sure. I would imagine that you can't go back. Well, now, there's an interesting twist to this in the case I recently had with these two people, and they were partners, and they broke up, the business went under, and there were certain sesuchim of a pashut of a mamonis, which I sat down with them, we settled. Then I told them, you have major ribbis issues, which could reach into tens of thousands, I don't think hundreds, but tens of thousands of dollars. There are ribbis issues on both sides. And the way I see it, to go back and get all of the ribbis payments, now each side took a loan. One side took a loan from the bank that went into the business, that's 12 years old, and the other side took a loan from relatives, which is 5-6 years old, and I told them we really have to calculate each month when there was profit, when there wasn't profit. It's very complicated. I suggested to them that it's up to them. If anyone wanted to be tevea, he could. Hey, yes, it was already paid. Whatever was paid was paid. Mechila helps even lechatchila. You're not obligated. If you pay someone with his ketsutza, there's no mitzvah for you to go after him. I suggested that before they sit down and calculate, they just be meichel each other. I told them it's going to end up being a pshara anyway, because it's not possible to trace back each month whether you made profit that month, especially a Yiddish business where, not everything is exactly on paper that can be traced. You know, figure it out. So I suggested, this is what I suggested. I sent the letter. I heard both sides, but I sent them a letter, and this was my suggestion. So, I just suggested that this is complex, that they do it. Gradually, as I was writing, I was thinking, Chazal say, somebody who's Isaac and Rubis, the size of this Maitetin, his business goes under. I was thinking, business was running, but Rubis, it was really never a very successful business, and unfortunately it was running for Rubis. Well, I didn't put that in there. I didn't want to rub it in. But, so afterwards, which in principle they both agreed, one person came to me with a time. He said, as part of the adjustments that were being made to come to a final figure of who owes who, there was a figure of the person who borrowed money from the bank. They paid the bank every month from the business, and everything was fine. The person owed money to his relatives. He was his relative, so every month, he gave him the, let's say, $500 a month, and every few months he would give the business an invoice and get it back. And that's the way it ran. At the time the business closed, it was 6 months worth of interest that was outstanding. He had paid his relative. So this person had an interesting taina. He said, I'm asking, should we both be Michael or with this that was paid? But 1 minute. Part of the calculations, he asked for an adjustment of $3,000 for 6 months worth of ribbis, actually $1,500 because it's his half. So he's asking for that adjustment. That adjustment is ribbis ktsutza lechatchila. I'm not allowed to pay it. You can't tell me to pay it. It's also for me to pay it. Because now I am paying ribbis ktsutza. So we'll be Michael everything else, but this money, he laid out the money, he paid his relatives, which is what he should do. He was the one who borrowed it. He's asking me now to pay him half the interest for that old loan. I can't pay interest for that loan. Now that's Ribbis Dei Raisin. Very interesting to me. What?
What?
So that's the truth. The truth is, this was his tviya. So when he told the tviya over the phone, it sounded correct. However, Rav Moshe, as we once said, and this gets complicated, remember Rav Moshe says that all interest payments are calculated as principal payments, which means that it becomes very complicated. The outstanding balance included money that he paid. Look, the business folded. So he had guaranteed the bank loan. He paid whatever was left in the bank loan. He paid his relatives. Whatever was included in his relatives' loan. Now they're making adjustments. The truth is that if you go through Moshe's cheshbon, everything that had been paid by one partner to the other partner, and he didn't pay the other partner, he paid his bill, Moshe says you count it as principal rather than as interest. So that, this opens up a tremendous can of worms for the person with the bank loan, because it's 12 years old. So So let's just say, argument's sake, he borrowed $500,000 12 years ago. It was actually a line of credit, so a fluctuator, which makes it more complicated. But for simple calculation, let's say it was $500,000. And he was paying on $500,000, what is he paying a month? Let's say $2,500 a month, he was paying interest. Okay? So he's paying $2,500 a month. Every month for 12 years, he's paying $1,250 from the other person. But coming to him, that should be deducted from principal, from the $500,000. Which means that actually, his timer should backfire in his face. Why? Because the other partner, if he wants, can say, look, you borrowed $500,000. I pay $1,250 a month of interest. Ramesha says that I'm entitled to deduct that from principal. $1,250 a month is let's say the loan was 10% a year. So over 10 years, I paid up the entire loan. My chayak of the principal is totally paid up. Now, the business folded, you paid $500,000. You're being tevei me $250 for my half of the principal. I paid the principal already. Because you borrowed money from the bank, you lent it to the business. Let's just talk simply. So every month when I paid, I'm really paying the principal that you lent. And now you're in big trouble. Because now I've been paying down the principal, I don't even know it. Except that in those months when there was profits, this argument wouldn't hold water. This only holds water in those months when there are no profits. So actually this argument, it sort of flies back in his face. And I don't know how it'll turn out, because the other loan was, 5-6 years ago. The first years they did make profit. So I don't know who would end up ahead and who would end up behind. But once you're going to start with this argument, it becomes very complicated. And Lamaisa, both sides are following my advice to just... 5-6 years ago, the first years they did make profit. So I don't know who would end up ahead and who would end up behind. But once you're going to start with this argument, it becomes very complicated. And Lamaisa, both sides are following my advice to just stay out of this issue by having ISCA arrangements in the beginning of the partnership. You have a head ISCA clause which states that any loan made to it is done under the terms of that ISCA. The head ISCA has to be explained. If one's an active partner, one's a silent partner, it's easier. If they both know what's going on in the business, it's a little complicated, and it has to be done properly. Now, I bothered Mindy to go upstairs. There's a unrelated to partnership issue, which I don't know if this is new, your accountants will know. I'm going to read to you part of it, but basically, there's a new chiddush that the IRS, I don't know if it's new to me, a chiddush that the IRS has. This is from a February 2005 accountant's journal. Loans that you make to your son. Your son's buying a house, you lend him $100,000. No interest, you're from the youth. Interfamily loans. Yeah, I'll have to read the whole thing to make it simple. Not the whole pages, but the beginning. Parents also make loans to their children or other family members so they can buy a bigger home, put a swimming pool in the backyard, or start a business. Because it's all in the family, these loans are often interest-free and undocumented. However, family lenders should be aware of tax consequences of making intrafamily loans and should plan ahead to avoid unintended incomes. Intrafamily loans have both income tax and gift tax consequences if they're not structured properly. For example, a parent makes an undocumented loan to a child and does not charge interest. It's likely the loan will be deemed by the IRS as a gift to the child. The loan could unintentionally use up a portion of the parent's gift tax unified credit amount, which I'll explain. What it means is the following. The IRS says a loan is worth money. Every loan is worth a certain amount of interest. Now, they don't go with the bank interest. They have what they call the applicable federal rates, or the AFR rates, which means a normal loan is 3-4% these days. Which means if you lend your son $100,000 and you don't charge interest, they say, 1 minute, you're entitled to 3% to $3,000. Those $3,000 are actually a gift to the child. Because you're being like, over the interest, it's a gift to the child. Now, one second. I'm allowed to give $3,000 a gift to my child. I can give every year, what is it, $11,000 each parent can give a gift. There's no gift tax consequence. But it's more serious. The IRS says, no, you earn $3,000 interest, and then gave it as a gift to the child. So we're going to tax you twice for giving this free loan. First of all, you have income tax, because you made a loan. You took money out of your bank, and you lent it to someone, and let's say you lent them $100,000. Now let's say you lent them $300,000. So you are getting 4%, which means $300,000, you're getting $12,000. That's income. It's true, you have Michaelis, you gave it to the child, but that's a gift. You can't give a gift unless you got something.
So the IRS, they
say you earned $12,000 interest, and then in turn you gave it as a gift to the child. Now, the one problem is you're going to have to pay income tax. And the second problem is that you are going to...
What?
No, I'm saying the IRS problem. The IRS problem is you're going to have to pay income tax. And the second problem is that they're going to look at it as a gift to the child. Now, each parent is entitled to give a child presently $11,000 a year to each child. The child's married to both, so two parents and two children give up to $44,000 a year in gifts. Now, when it comes to estate planning, it becomes a serious issue because parents, all parents should plan for estate because basically estate taxes, they still exist. If they'll be phased out, we don't know. But the way estate taxes work now is wealthy people pay zero in estate taxes. Poor people who have estates of less than $1.5 million pay zero. The first $1.5 million is excluded from estate taxes. The middle income people who have $2-3 million, now you're going to say, $2 million. Yeah, you look at your house, you're right away you're going to start pushing what you have. And it's a big problem. Many parents are reluctant to recognize that they have over $1 million. $1.5 million now? Is it $1.5 million, I think? What?
Life insurance.
Life insurance, unless it's owned by the child, is counted as well. So, if drugs is owned by the child, then it's not counted. But giving it to the child itself is a gift consequence. So the people who are really suffering by estate taxes, there was a well-known doctor, a very popular family doctor on 15th Avenue in Borough Park, who did not make estate planning. He was not a very rich man. He had a very successful business. When he died, his kids had to sell his house just to pay the IRS. The IRS looked at his business, which he was married to his kids, as having great value. It was a very successful business. They argued the business was tied to the person. He was dead. The kid wasn't a doctor. What's he going to do with the business? You know, the family business. And the IRS, it was all the nicer, and all the tax accountants, the stakeholders, tell this nicer to everybody, because the kids suffered terribly. The parents put away money, and the IRS really hit them very, very hard. And I'm going to go off track, but there's a certain amount that you can do in planning. Now, if you gift your child money in a year in excess of the $11,000, the IRS counts that extra amount of the gift off your entitlement. You have a lifetime entitlement of, now it's $1.5 million. It's going up, I think, every year incrementally to a runoff, and the way it's structured, it goes back to when you're phased out, and then it goes back to the old, which means you have to be lucky to die in the right year, sort of. If you die too late, you're in trouble. It makes no sense. It was structured that way so they can decide later. The assumption is they're going to decide later. If they're phased out of state taxes, they'll not be again. There are ways of structuring things. Now, this particular issue has to be structured the right way. People are at a stage where children are buying homes and they want to help their child. It has to be structured in a proper way to avoid all of these consequences. Now, it's likely that if the consequences, the $3,000 or $8,000 or $12,000 we're talking about, that nobody, is that true? That nobody will wake up to it. But it's something which, with the right amount of planning, could be avoided. If I was a lawyer, would argue that this basically requires formally written to charge with us.
But the law is saying is that you can't get an interest-free loan to your child. What? One point could argue that's a freedom of admission. I can't do it. So it's a, except for the person could argue, of course, a way out is for the child to take, the IRS allows the free loan society to give free loans. I don't know why they allow that. I guess they're giving charity any time you give out charity. There are a lot of free loan societies that give free loans. And, it was quid pro quo, I don't know how the IRS would look at it, but if there was some understanding, maybe it would be different. And this is just an issue that I wanted to bring up to you. But we have one more issue, and that is where to go from here next week. As far as the remaining issues with the Srubis are not suitable for us to learn inside for various reasons. Some of them are complex, and some of them have a lot of non-Negeya type of issues. There's one Simon which I couldn't even if I wanted. There's one Simon that has, is called Simon Kuf Samaches Kuf Samachtes. It's like if you had a trivial question on. In halacha, which siman of shochet aruch has two numbers, right? So the siman of shochet aruch is called kusamaches, kusamaches. There's no logical reason it should have two names. Apparently, it was a printer's error when they originally set the simanim. I never heard of a good explanation of why it's called by two numbers, but it deserves to